Dr. Horn is a clinical child psychologist, and he served from 2001 to 2007 as the Assistant Secretary for Children and Families within the U.S. government, within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And he oversaw there a budget of over, a total budget of $47 billion. And it said that Dr. Horn served as the focal point for much of family policy in the U.S., in the whole U.S., including responsible fatherhood and healthy marriage initiatives. From 1994 to 2001, Dr. Horn was president of the National Fatherhood Initiative, whose mission is to improve the well-being of children by increasing the number of children growing up with involved, committed, and responsible fathers. And prior to working in government, Dr. Horn was the director of outpatient psychological services at the Children's Hospital National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., and an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at George Washington University. I think that because of Dr. Horn's experience both in government and in private, we have a person today who can bring us great insight as to how government can work through government policy to encourage strong, healthy families. Now, I should say that Dr. Horn's books weren't available to bring in today, but if you are interested in buying one of Dr. Horn's books, leave your name and your info with the bookstore, and they will order a copy for you. So, Dr. Horn, thank you for being here with us today, and the mic is yours.
Well, thank you very much for that lovely introduction. It's great to be here. I want to thank Dave and IMFC for the invitation to be here with you. Listening to that introduction, I couldn't help but think back to an introduction that I received some years ago from someone, probably one of the most important people in my life. And at that time, it was my then 5-year-old daughter who was in kindergarten. And she had been chosen to be the superstar of the week in her kindergarten class. Now this, if people have children, raise your hand, so you know how really proud a moment that is to have your daughter chosen to be the superstar of her kindergarten class. And there was a celebration at the end of the week for this great honor that she had, and she invited her mom and me and her older sister to join the celebration. And at the beginning of it, had to introduce the members of her family to her kindergarten class. So she started out by saying, "This is my older sister, Kristen. She's really nice, and we like to play together." And then she said, "And this is my mom. And my mom has this really important job. And at this really important job, she writes these really important papers. And then she flies all around the country giving talks about these really important papers that she writes at a really important job." Now, all of that is true, and we're very proud of the work that my wife does, but I wasn't paying much attention because I knew I was next. And at the time, I was the commissioner for the Administration on Children, Youth, and Families, and in the first Bush administration, I was overseeing an $8 billion agency. I was feeling really good about where I was in life and couldn't wait to see what my 5-year-old daughter would say about me. And she said, "And this is my dad." And I puffed out my chest. She said, "This is my dad. He cleans the house." So, so next time, Derek, you introduce me, please. That's my most important attribute, apparently, for my daughter. I'm going to talk a little bit today about my experience in the U.S. and policymaking around family issues, particularly focused on fatherhood and healthy marriage. And I want to start at the onset by saying that I know that your social and political context here in Canada is not exactly the same as in the U.S. So not everything that I say is going to be right on target in terms of relevancy for Canada, but there may be some interesting parallels and some interesting lessons learned that we went through in family policy making in the U.S. that might be of interest to you. But before I start with that, because I'm going to talk about fatherhood, I can't help but tell fatherhood stories. This one fast forward, my oldest daughter was now 16, and I was the head of the National Fatherhood Initiative, and it was about a month before Father's Day, and she came to me and she said, "Dad, I know what I want to buy you for Father's Day." Now, when you run the National Fatherhood Initiative, Father's Day is kind of an important holiday in their household, so she said, "I know I want to buy you as a gift." Now, this is a month out. I'm like, "Oh, okay, well, what's that?" She said, "I want to bring you to a rock concert." I thought, you know, it'd be one of these, you know, revival group things, you know, Dave Clark Five Returns, Jerry and the Pacemakers, this time with real pacemakers. No, she said, "I want to take you to the Dave Matthews Band concert," which I thought was kind of, you know, it's a hip group, friend. And I said, I was very, you know, she's 16, you know, and she wants to be seen with me at a rock concert. And she said, "Wait, I need your help in buying the tickets." So I got out my credit card and I, you know, bought the tickets. But still, I'm like, you know, on cloud nine, you know, 16, most of the times they want you to drop them off at school 3 blocks away so they're not seen with them. And I'm just going to go to a rock concert with them. And she came to me about 2 weeks later, and she said, "Dad, I've got a problem." I said, "What's that?" She says, "See, there's this boy." Now, I figure any conversation with a 16-year-old daughter that begins, "You see, there's this boy," is one that's not going to go real good for me. And she says, "There's this boy, and I kind of want to use your ticket. Go with him." Now, see, I'm a child psychologist, so I knew enough not to say, "The heck you are." Instead, I said, I took a deep breath. I said, "Well, I'm not going to tell you what to do in terms of what the right decision is. But what I want you to do is I want you to take a few days, and I want you to pray about this and talk it over with God. And you and God come to, like, what the right decision is." Now, I thought that was pretty good, especially for a Presbyterian. And so my daughter went away, and she came back, and she said about 2 days later, she said, "Dad, I did what you said. I prayed about this, talked this over with God, what was the right thing to do. And God and I both feel real bad for you." So, now, this is the same daughter who many years earlier at her sixth grade graduation, she has a beautiful singing voice, and at six she had a solo. And my wife and I we did sixth grade graduations in Maryland for some reason, and we're like in these bleachers off to the side. And it came time for her to do her solo, and she took a step forward, sang the thing, and then she stepped back. And she did one of these. We're over here, she went and smiled. Very brief smile. And the thought occurred to me, what if she looked over there at the bleachers and I wasn't there? That is, unfortunately, the tragic circumstance for so many children, at least in America and increasingly around the world. When in a moment of triumph, they glance to the bleachers and their dad's not there, because their dad doesn't live with them, often doesn't even live in the same neighborhood, and isn't there for those kinds of moments. In fact, I believe that one of the most consequential social trends of our time is the increasing number of kids who are growing up without dads in the home. In the U.S. in 1960, less than 10 million children lived in a household without a father. Today, that number is about 25 million. It means that tonight, this very night in the United States, 4 out of 10 children will go to sleep in a home in which their father does not live. By some estimates, for children born from 1990 and onward, that number may increase to 60%. That is, for 60% of children born in the U.S., they will spend at least some portion of their childhood in a home in which their father does not reside. And this is a different kind of father absence than we have experienced in throughout human history. There have always been fatherless children. If you look at the at the Bible, there are lots of references to a command to take care of widows and the fatherless. What's different about this fatherlessness is for the first time in history, it's largely voluntary. Because for most of human history, a fatherless home was due to death of the father. And what's really interesting about the research on the difference between the impact of a father's death and a father absence because he lives somewhere else is that father death, while a very difficult circumstance for children, generally children survive it fairly well. The same cannot be said for voluntary absence. Now the pathway, today's pathways to fatherless households tend to be, first of all, divorce. The divorce rate in the U.S. nearly tripled between 1960 and 1980, before leveling off and declining slightly. About 40 out of every 100 first marriages in the U.S. now end in divorce, compared to about 16 out of 100 first marriages in 1960. The result is about 1 million children a year in the United States experiencing parental divorce. The second pathway is out-of-wedlock fathering. In 1960, only about 5% of all births in the U.S. were fathered by men out of wedlock. This increased to almost 11% in 1970, 18% in 1980, 28% in 1990, and in excess of 36% today. Now, just because a father doesn't live with one's children does not mean that they cannot stay actively involved in their children's lives. Of course they can. Many do, but it is harder. 40% of American children in father-absent households have not seen their father at all, not once, in the previous year. More than half who don't live with their fathers have never been in their father's home. Whereas 57% of unwed fathers consistently visit their children during the first 2 years of their lives, by the time the child reaches 7.5, that drops to less than 25%. The fact of the matter is, when fathers are not married to the mothers of their children, they are far less likely to reside in their children's homes, and even more tragically, far less likely over time to stay connected to their kids. Now, in addition to physical absence of fathers, we also know that there are far too many dads who are in the home and psychologically disconnected from their children. Overall today, American parents spend roughly 40% less time with their children than parents did a generation ago. Almost 20% of 6th through 12th graders have not had a good conversation lasting at least 10 minutes with at least one parent in more than a month. Let me say that again, because it's stunning. 20% of 6th through 12th graders, the exact moment when they are struggling about their identity and how they're going to transition to independence, 20% have not had a good conversation lasting at least 10 minutes with one of their parents in over a month. 36% of parents do not give any time to their kids' extracurricular activities. In regard to fathers, a Gallup poll found that 50% of all adults in the U.S. agreed that with the statement that fathers today spend less time with their children than their fathers did with them. Now there are some who say, wait, so what? What's the big deal? I mean, this is, we're the modern family, it's just different. It's not, you know, and it's no great consequence to children that these guys are not there. Well, the research suggests something very different. 75% of American children living in single-parent households, mostly single-mother households, experience poverty before they turn 11, compared to only 20% of those living in two-parent households. Violent criminals in the U.S. are overwhelmingly males who grew up without fathers, including 60% of rapists, 75% of adolescents charged with murder, and 70% of long-term prison inmates. Even after controlling for economic factors, children living in father-absent homes are also more likely to be suspended or expelled from school or to drop out, to have been treated for an emotional behavioral problem, to commit suicide as adolescents, or be victims of child abuse or neglect. Now, does this mean that children cannot be raised successfully without a father present? Of course not. Many are. But there is a non-trivial increase in risk of poor outcomes for children who live absent their dads. Now, I spend a lot of time in airports, far too much time in airports. I can tell you, like, where the best restaurants are, you know. It's just, I don't ever fly in or out of Dulles or JFK. Little advice. So I came up with an analogy to talk about this non-trivial increase in risk. Imagine that you arrive at an airport ticket counter, and you're there, and you say, I've got my flight from Ottawa to Washington, D.C. And the ticket counter agent says, you're in luck. We've got two planes. They're both going to leave at exactly the same time. You've got the exact same seat on both planes. And you're going to get to your destination at exactly the same time. Which plane do you want to get on? You'd probably say, well, it doesn't sound like there's any difference. Is there anything I should know? Is there any difference? Oh, yes, just one. The first plane will get you there 99 out of 100 times without crashing. And the second plane will get you there 90 out of 100 times without crashing. Now, which plane do you want to get on? Now, personally, I want to get on the one that has a 100% chance of not crashing. But if I had to get on one of those, we all do the mental calculation and we say, well, of course, I'm going to get on the first one, not the second one. But if you think about it, 90% of the time, that second plane still gets there just fine. But it has this non-trivial increase of a crash. This is the way I, at least, like to think about the consequences for children of growing up without dads. Many of them will get to the destination fine. But there is a non-trivial increase in risk of poor outcomes for those kids. And if we could avoid it for as many children as we could, why would we not implement social policies to do that? Now, carry the analogy a little bit further. Imagine now these two planes are up in the air, and you're the air traffic controller. Would you say to yourself, you know, that second plane, that's got a really high risk of crashing. It's going to make me look real bad, so I'm not going to pay any attention to it. I'm going to pay all my attention to the first plane. Or would you say it is precisely because the second plane has an increased risk of crashing that we should pay special attention to it and ensure that it also arrives safely? Me, if I were the air traffic controller, I would do the latter, which is why I can be a very strong advocate for fatherhood and for marriage, and yet still be a strong advocate for support services for kids who live in something other than a two-parent household. It seems to me that we can do both. Be clear about the increased risk, not pretend it's not there, but be clear about the increased risk while at the same time providing the kinds of supports for the passengers on that plane, for the kids in those families, to get to their destination safely. Here's how one famous author wrote about it. Quote, every society requires a critical mass of families that fit the traditional ideal, both to meet the needs of most children and to serve as a model for other adults who are raising children in difficult settings. And the author goes on, we are at risk of losing that critical mass today. Who is that author? Then First Lady, now Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, in her best-selling book, It Takes a Village. So given that children do best when they grow up with the love and devotion of both a mom and a dad, what can be done to increase the number of children growing up with both a mom and a dad? Well, let me provide some ideas. First, we need a culture that is better at celebrating the unique and irreplaceable contributions that fathers make to the well-being of their children. Unfortunately, for most of the 20th century, fathers were seen as mostly economic providers for their kids. In fact, Michael Lamb, a noted child development specialist, 30 years ago described fathers as, quote, the forgotten contributors to child development, unquote. And he was right. By the early 1990s, In the U.S. at least, we were in danger of losing the very idea of fatherhood. Back in the early 1990s, we were told, don't even use the word. It was partner, significant other. It was not dad. It was caregiver, not father. When we started the National Fatherhood Initiative in 1994, a year later, in 1995, in the June issue of the American Psychologist, the major professional publication of the American Psychological Association, of which I was a proud member at the time, its lead article was titled, The Superfluous Father. The culture, by the early 1990s, had rejected the idea, at least elite culture, that fathers were mattered. Oh yes, their money was important. Child support. But what they do is not much different or important. And in fact, if you want to be a good dad, the message was, be more like mom. Well, unfortunately for that perspective, research was being done about fathers and how fathers behave with children. And what they started to find, research by people like Michael Lamb, Ross Park, and others, and even Mavis Hetherington, that fathers, in fact, do some things different than moms do when it comes to interacting with their kids. So, for example, research shows that moms tend to be more verbal with their kids. They sing songs to their kids. They talk to their kids. And dads like to be more physical. In fact, they had this description of dads doing something called rough and tumble play. Now, back in the early 1980s, the message was, and stop it. They said, why do we have all these violent kids? It's because these stupid men are like playing rough with their kids. And so we got to get them to stop doing that, and then the kids will be just fine. Well, what research has actually shown is that rough and tumble play is very important for the development, healthy development of kids, particularly males. Because what happens in rough and tumble play is that children learn the capacity for self-control. I am not self-controlled because I don't suddenly levitate from the stage and fly around the room. I can't do that. I'm self-controlled, though, when I resist a first nature impulse to engage in aggression, or to lie, to get my way. That's self-control. So when a father is engaging in rough and tumble play with his kids, if the child becomes too rambunctious, what does the father say? The father doesn't say, hey, hit me harder, pull my hair harder, you know, tug it all out, you know. What a father says is, he says, hey, slow down, calm down. If you're getting too wild, or if you continue, I'm going to stop playing. Well, what's the child learning? He's learning I can go this far with my aggression, but not further. He's learning how to control it, to exert intentionality to it. In fact, there are consequences. There was a study that looked at male inmates on death row, and they found that 90% of them reported never playing with their fathers in this way. Research also shows that